from MLU headquarters in Philadelphia. This is Cleats and Cufflinks.
Welcome to another episode of Cleats and Cufflinks. I'm Nick Darling. I'm here with Dusty Rhodes. And we're back after week five of the MLU season?
Seems to be.
Week five?
Got week five. Some teams with five wins. Teams with six wins.
Yeah.
So it must be at least week three if they've got six wins, right?
At the very minimum.
We haven't run anybody with a bunch of doubleheaders to start the season yet.
No, we haven't run through that. But yeah, I mean, it was an exciting weekend out there. We got to see, I mean, it was a weekend of big wins. Let's put it that way. Big wins.
Sort of confirmation of what we had seen so far in the season. And since we're at about sort of the midway point of, as we said, five wins, six wins, that area, you start to get a sense of who the teams seem to be. Mm. But I believe we talked about this last week when we were talking about the format of the season and everything. It's far from finished. You know, teams with four losses can end up with six wins, that sort of flavor to it. So these teams can still turn things around for positive or negative.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's still a lot of season left, and we're gonna be keeping a close eye on it. But before we get too far into the show, we're going to talk about two things. First of all, we're going to talk about the jersey that you have on today. I want to start there.
Well, so we've got a Trenton Takers jersey. This is from after my, this is my post-retirement club, one of the two that I've played on after actual retiring, from Trenton, New Jersey, except that I don't think any of the players on Trenton were from Trenton, New Jersey.
You just co-opted Trenton,
right?
Your hometown.
It's a bunch of Jersey and like Pennsylvania, so from that extended area. Team was very fun to play with, had some future stars playing on that team. But if you've been over the bridges in the Trenton area, you'll see that one of the bridges says, Trenton makes, the world takes, which is kind of where we took the name of this jersey from, that and the idea of we were the takers in the economy, and we were unapologetically taking from everybody.
Yeah, and for those who can't see the jersey, it has a big takers across the front, the number. It's an homage to the Trailblazers?
Is this bingo. Right? Yeah. And that's kind of why I'm wearing it today is because as Steph Curry kind of rocked the Trailblazers to sleep in the 17-point overtime performance of his, I felt that, you know, I should give a little shout to the Blazers, who had a very good season and all that. They're not done yet. It's only 3-1. But when State is kind of beating you without going to the nuclear option, and then they bring the nuclear option on in.
Yeah.
It's going to be over for the Blazers very soon.
It seems very likely. I also like that it has the little sublimated kind of take all over it too. So it's a good jersey.
I enjoy this.
You should
one
post
a
picture of this jersey for the for the people out there just listening.
And finally, it's number 30 also, being Rasheed Wallace.
Oh, see,
my favorite Blazer of all time.
Deep in the references.
Disc don't lie, ball don't lie. There's a similarity there.
Yeah, I'm seeing the matchups. I'm seeing the combination. The next thing we need to do, of course, and I do love this jersey. Maybe we'll hang that one up for the next show if you bring it back down.
I'm going to have to take it with me. I don't know if I can part with it.
You can bring it back. You can bring it back.
Maybe.
Because next week you have to wear your Heavy Seas jersey, which, of course, leads us to our sponsor. So we want to say thank you, as we always do, to our sponsor who provides our refreshment, among other things, for us here.
I do like to be refreshed.
Cleats and Cufflinks. That's Heavy Seas Brewing Company out of Baltimore. I'm going to go ahead and open mine while we discuss these guys. They, you know, great partner of the pod.
Partner POP.
So far. Great POP. Good pop so far. And, you know, I am drinking today the Crossbones, which is their session IPA. It tells me that it has full-on hop aroma with a surprisingly rich mouthfeel. This session IPA delivers a broad side of flavor without getting your powder wet. Now, that's some good bottle copy right there.
I recall that one from last time, attempting to get through the powder wet bit.
Quality bottle copy.
And it's also got the that's the hop water, as I recall, is what we're aiming for there.
Going for hop water, yeah.
And this is the surprisingly enjoyable pills, as I recall, the pounder pills.
Yeah, both of us drinking a relatively lighter fare today.
That's good. I have no complaints about that.
Yeah.
And this one is named for the weight of their shot. The most common naval cannons were called six-pounders at Heavy Seas. That means a six-pack of crisp, clean pounder pills. I do like the pounder pills.
I love that. I feel like we're both auditioning to be to be voiceover actors.
Well, only vaguely, because we're moonlighting on the sort of bottle copy reading gig.
Yeah.
And since we're not doing it a bunch of times, we're not doing the "these pretzels are making me thirsty" sort of bit. Yeah. We're just doing it straight through.
We're not getting a lot of practice, I feel like.
Yeah.
I feel like, and this is to all the people out there who are like, maybe I'll hire these guys. I feel like we'll get better. Given we'd the opportunity to do some more repetition.
I would have to consciously attempt to get worse at it.
Well, cheers.
Indeed, sir. Cheers. Another week in the books.
Oh, yeah. That is a, that's a tasty beverage right there. That's what that is. So, first of all, let's talk a little bit about this past weekend. So, tell the folks what you were up to this past weekend.
This past week, we got to, well, I got to go see New York host Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
Up in Orange, New Jersey. I kind of like the stadium out there. It's got a nice open-air feel to it. And we saw the Spinners do kind of what we expected the Spinners to do against the Rumble, where, the Rumble keep making these plays here and there. They show some promise, but they undermine it with unforced errors. And the Spinners this year are taking full advantage of unforced errors and then forcing some on top of that. Aside from that, I mean, I called that game, did pretty well with that. Some hiccups here and there. I'm always looking for things that I can improve on.
Working to get better.
Going back and listening to the tapes and all of that. But one of the things I saw a lot this week was just hucks into double coverage.
Mm.
A lot of teams hucking into double coverage.
I see that as confidence in one's receiver.
Yeah, yeah. It just stuck out this week. So I'm working up a little bit of a piece on that to type about it a little bit and how some teams just win when they huck into double coverage and other teams are always.
Yeah. Portland.
Well, some of those are hucking past double coverage.
Often.
Right? Yeah. It's a little bit different. It's
not that's true.
Floating up there, a little, getting all messy and all of that. It's sending it out to someone who has the advantage speed-wise.
Yeah. Yeah, I had an interesting weekend.
Yeah.
So I was scheduled to come into the office here.
I saw some video of that on one of the games.
Yeah. We did a little office cam. We still haven't quite decided how we want to get that in there, but it was there. So I scheduled to come in for around 7 for the 9 o'clock start of the Vancouver game. So coming at 7, I meet with Chris, who I work with on that game. We go through our notes, make sure we're all on the same page, make sure everything's working. But we had a technical issue. So I'm at home, and I'm working on our 2017 sales deck, which, by the way, is a huge project. but very, very important, because if you're not sowing seeds in the spring, you have nothing to harvest in the fall.
That's true.
So we're starting that process right now, which is kind of crazy. You know, you're always kind of a year ahead in that stuff, at least. And we're just getting to that point. You know, we've been kind of working backward.
See, and this is the other side of the job for you, because for me, I always feel like I'm about a year behind when I'm working at MLU. It's like I'm trying to react to things that I learned last year when I'm playing. So this is the sort of, you have to plan all of this stuff so it happens so that I and others can feel like they're behind.
Yeah, that's the goal. So anyway, I'm at home doing some work on that, and I get a call from the office that the software that we use to ingest all of the live streams from around the country and then put them back out with graphics and all that has a bug. And we call the support, and we're like, hey, this isn't working. And they're like, yeah, we have a bug. We're like, when's it going to be fixed? We're not really sure. We're very confused about this bug. And we're like, okay. So
we think it's cute. We're going to hold on to it.
Yeah, maybe we'll keep it for a while. So we have this problem right before game set time for San Francisco and Portland. And Scott Helm, who's here like managing the show, somehow manages to work a workaround where he basically sends the video to a different monitor, does a monitor capture to get that into the software. I don't know. It's technical. It's confusing. I don't understand. But he manages a workaround, and he gets this in and is actually able to get the game up and live. Unfortunately, in that process somewhere, we lose the audio.
This is the part I was familiar with.
Yeah. So he calls me, and I'm trying to work on it with him. And finally, I'm like, well, we can call it from there. So I drop what I'm doing and come down to the office, and we get Chris to come in early, and we sit down, and we actually did the second half of the game from here. So the second half of the game from here, a little bit of a break, and then went right into the Vancouver game. So it was a hectic day.
Yeah.
And calling And we're going to have this experience soon. We're not going to talk about that quite yet. But calling two games in a row or a game and a half in a row is definitely a lot of on time.
Yeah, and especially if you don't know that you need to prepare for two games beforehand. Because I can vouch for the fact that I try to show up to the stadiums 2 to 3 hours in advance because I have a number of tasks that I want to get through. I like to write out the roster so that I can remember the names better, do a couple other weird things that just take time. So if you get that interrupted, you have to call another game.
Yeah, it definitely shook up that. And Luke also pointed out to me, Luke Ryan, our stats guy, I used one of his stats about the half field pull, the fact that we've already had more breaks off half field pulls this year than all of last year. And I had that all queued up in my mind for the Vancouver game, but it came out during the San Francisco game. It was clearly not polished enough or well prepared enough. He's like, you wasted my good stat by not using it where you meant to use it. I'm like, I'm thrown off.
It's those unanticipated moments where you flub a little bit or do whatever, and it's trying to recover from that and not draw attention to it without passing over it, without like giving a little hat tip to, yes, I messed up there. Your ears aren't wrong.
Yeah.
But you don't want to dwell.
I thought Chris, the guy I was working with, did a great job because a couple of times, I mean, he was just thrown into it.
Yeah.
Like, you got to do play-by-play now. Here's the rosters. And so a couple of times he started calling the right numbers but matching them with players on the wrong roster. But he recovered very well from it. And, you know, you just got to apologize.
Yeah.
Switch back, move on.
Do the right thing going forward.
Absolutely. So I did all that, and both games, they weren't that close. You know, right. They kind of got away from the teams. Now, the Vancouver game, I will say, I was impressed with the team through the first three quarters. I felt like they held on pretty well. They did a nice job in that game. But there was a moment in the game that's going to lead into the next thing we wanted to talk about here, where Vancouver gets a block, and they're set to get within one. And they put up a long huck. Kind of a dangerous one, floats a little bit, but the defender misreads it. The Seattle defender misreads it. He goes up early, misses it, and it lands right in the lap of a Vancouver player who is in the end zone. And you're like, they're back for a split second, because in the next second, the disc hits the ground, and he drops it. And, you know, we've talked about this a lot, and we get feedback on this, and how you respond to those situations, particularly throughout a game, the situations that are kind of negative, if you will, for the team. How, as an announcer, you're supposed to respond? You know, you have to be critical. You have to do these things. But how you respond and why some situations are more difficult than others. A blowout's tough to call.
Yeah.
Because you constantly have to be finding the sunny side in some way for the team.
And it depends on the character of the blowout also. If a team, say, we've seen this from DC in that year where they won a bunch. It's like they're just out getting blocks on the opponent.
Yeah.
So in that scenario, you can talk about what DC is doing well, or you can talk about how they are getting those advantages specifically. But when we're talking about unforced errors, just drops, there's nothing else to talk about other than that specific action, that one moment where a player just couldn't do the thing that he's literally there to do.
Yeah, yeah. And it's such a, you know, ultimate moving from person to person to person. The drop is so jarring that the initial response to it is just like, I can't believe he dropped that.
Oh, that's sad there.
Oh, no.
If you see enough of them, you hear something like me where drops make me sad.
Drops make me sad.
They just make me sad. Because the whole sport is it's connection between teammates. It's kind of like a spider web. It's like you connect all of these passes, all of these different dots between your team, attempted to get from one end to the other end. But if you disconnect one of them, it all falls apart. It crumples into a ball of nothing.
Yeah, yeah. And it's so sudden in a way that a normal throwaway isn't. Like, somebody makes a bad throw, there's still so much possibility for so long. It's in the air. You're like, I think that's going out of bounds. Maybe someone's going to be able to do something about it.
Giving chase to it.
Yeah. It looks like it's too far in front of them, but I don't know. Maybe it'll sit up.
Yeah.
You know, there's always moments, but the drop is like, it's already caught in your mind.
Yeah, because you're
and as
you're
an announcer,
ahead.
You're moving on to the next thing. You're like, you know, it goes to this guy and you look downfield because you want to figure out where he might throw it next.
And often that's sort of the give and take between the play-by-play and the color is that the play-by-play is watching the person with the disc, making sure he knows who it's going to right around there, trying to anticipate a little bit. Whereas a lot of times the color guy will look downfield and not even watch the disc necessarily, or the person with the Frisbee.
You're almost listening to him to know where the disc is.
So and you see the disc go up, and you just assume, oh, that'll be a completion, because we're that's why we're here, we're completing passes. So then you try to read, as you say, going downfield from there, and responding appropriately can be very difficult, but this is part of the character of Ultimate. The game gets changed when negative things happen. So these negative plays are the most, sometimes the most important plays in the game. If you're talking a moment where they can be within one, and if Seattle goes back and scores that goal, then they're behind three.
Which they do. And then so the game from the that difference. Point on is relatively out of hand. And the thing is let's be clear about this. Everyone drops a disc sometimes.
Yes.
Like, drops are just they're a thing. Like, you know, a little loss of concentration, a little jump from some wind. Like,
and
you
the more involved you are.
Yeah.
If you have 400 passes in a season,
you're
400
likely
catches,
to have a drop.
You don't even need to have a high drop percentage to get a couple drops in.
Yeah, it happens. So this is not in any way being critical necessarily of the players, but you get to a point where if you're seeing a lot of technical mistakes like drops, like throwaways, you know, those kind of errors, where you have to talk about it because it's such an important part of the narrative of the game. You know, when we see New York playing so well in many ways, making great defensive plays, actually having some good offensive movement, good cuts, but then they string together three or four unforced errors, it's impossible not to have that be part of the story.
And it's so the flip side of this is that we talk about these positive plays. We talk about big skies. We talk about layup blocks that you can see, you can sort of see developing. Talk about some giant throws that go up. It's easy as an announcer to get excited about that and say something positive, and your voice, it goes up. And you look at the thing that they just did.
It's quite a thing.
Look at that. And then it comes right again. And the next time it's like, that was almost a, that could have been good, I think.
I think.
So I've thought about this a while. Is it a reasonable position for me as an announcer to get really excited about negative things? So if I take the total opposite tack, I'm like, that was a fantastic drop. Is that just pouring salt on the wounds? Or can I?
It's tough because I've definitely had those kind of things happen in the games that I've called. You know, we had a dropped pull in that DC Boston game we're calling, and the reaction is, I can't, he dropped it.
I think everyone was failing to believe that he did that, including
him.
Himself.
He had no, he was completely oblivious. No, it's the fact that they're part and moments and part and parcel to the game, and sometimes they're turning points, sometimes they're hugely important. And I think that there's a tendency to want to be positive. You want to put things in a good light, and I think that's good. I think as an announcer, you want to talk positively more than you speak negatively, because the teams are developing. You don't want to, but fans often want you to.
They all take different tacks on this.
Yeah.
My instinct is to be negative, so I have to deal with that differently.
Yeah.
That's in part due to high expectations. I expect you to make all these catches. I expect you to make these throws, because these are the throws that you're choosing to make. But so when I see these things happen, it's difficult for me to reconcile that some positivity could be gleaned from this, or to keep in mind that I have literally talked about every negative thing for both teams that has happened over the course of four quarters, and sometimes you don't need to just be down about all of it.
Yeah, and it's a tough balance to strike, because again, it's storyline. And when we look at the shape of Ultimate in general, you said it right. It's a web. It's a string of options. And the moment when that changes, if it's a block, that's somehow still part of that string. It feels fluid. It feels kind of normal. If it's a deep throw that's contested,
right, we're
that
taking
feels
a shot
like part
there.
Of the string. It's a shot. If it's a short throw that's dropped, it's massively jarring. And I think about where we see that in other sports. And you brought up, we were trying to think in football what it would be.
Right.
And we thought, is it a dropped pass? Not really.
Not usually.
Because you're
going
to go back to the line of scrimmage, you have another shot at that usually, right? I mean, there are some,
but there are some, excellent instances of Terrell Owens, for example, dropping really important passes.
Yeah, yeah.
Very short passes that he's supposed to catch, being a Hall of Fame receiver and all of that.
Yeah.
But it's more the notion of the fumble.
The fumble feels more like the drop. And the reason the fumble feels like it to me is that when the disc goes up to an open receiver and you can see that no one's going to block it.
Right.
It feels already completed before it even gets there. Because these guys are very, very good at catching frisbees, it is almost always completed. Like, drops are relatively rare. So it feels like it's still in your possession, right? And it feels like that running back that's just gotten a first down and then goes for that extra little yard and gets hit and the ball pops out. Like, it's joy. We completed it. We're there. Followed immediately by just the horror of a turnover.
And it's in part because that receiver who is going to become the thrower is, if they know that they're open, they know that they're not under pressure, they get to choose how to address the disc.
Yeah.
So they're not being forced to catch it under duress. They're not having to reach out with one hand or two hands or hold off a defender. They can sort of choose their timing and just decide to catch it with two hands, which hand they want on top. If you prefer catching with one hand, you get to choose which hand. If you prefer catching with spin one way or the other, you get to select all of those items if you're an uncovered receiver, and you get to prepare for the next pass.
Yeah.
So this is one of the things that we talk about when we talk about frisbee skills, is how does each receiver become a thrower? So how do you move from a catch to a throw? So when we see these moments where the disc is going up, it's expected to be a completion, we're sort of judging that receiver who will then become a thrower on what they do next. How do they prepare for the next throw?
Yeah, so you're talking about now something that's a little beyond this, right? So we get through this idea of a drop, of this turnover, of this jarring thing, this simple thing, right? But we sometimes forget, too, that, you know, drops are, there's multiple reasons you can have a drop. Right. There's weather conditions, there's
wind, as you mentioned,
lack of concentration, there's all kinds of things.
Focus, taking your eye off.
The catches that these guys are making, though, out on the MLU field are actually often much more complex than the catches that you might see people making in a league game. Yeah. Because they're trying to do something more with a lot of the catches they're making. Not all of them. Some of them you're just trying to get your hands on it and close them.
Right.
But there's definitely, you know, I remember Woodside had a drop. Man, it was on a long throw, maybe last week against Vicuña down the sideline.
Yeah.
And it looked like he was really trying to get the catch so he could get it out in front of him and get his body turned, because he thought he had a follow-up throw coming up in the middle of the field.
The immediate continue, yeah.
Yeah, so he's looked like that's what he was trying to do, and he just lost concentration because he's trying to do something. Whereas if he had just clap caught it.
But that's the thing. He's relatively new to ultimate despite his obvious success.
Yeah.
So that sort of motion where you're bringing your hands in the same direction that the disc is traveling in order to set up your next throw, that's a standard ultimate play.
Yeah.
But if you have previously thought of catching as and throwing as two distinct parts, and you sort of rush the first part and don't really complete it, it's a different thing. So as soon as you touch the disc, in my head, that's the first part of your throw. It's either a fake or it's leading into your throw. And if you just haven't thought of yourself as a thrower, or thought of catching as easy, or what you need to do next, you're learning that motion from catching to throwing. One of the things that we talk about is, do you want your right hand on top, left hand on top? How do you want to catch to get to the throw most quickly? And I'll tell you, most of the players that I see who have very quick times, they catch with their non-dominant throwing hand. So like in baseball, if you have a glove on your left hand, you dig the ball out of your glove, throw it with your right hand. If you treat your left hand like a glove in frisbee, you just catch it with your left hand, dig it out with your right hand, and throw it. So it manages a quick transition a lot of the times.
Yeah, so we're getting in from there. You know, if you take this idea, and this is our technical discussion, right? So I think about it, you know, you brought this up, and it's not something that I'd given as much thought to, but this idea of not only the time between a catch and a throw, though that is a very important thing, but also how you're setting your throw up in that. And it brought me back to playing soccer. And you'd get we'd work all the time on settling the ball, on touch, on trapping the ball. So when the ball comes to you, you know, someone kicks it the long distance to you, your ability to settle it is primary, right? That's like the catch.
This is the key skill that I was lacking in soccer, by the way, was touch.
It's an important skill. But that's like the catch, you know.
Yeah.
Now, the next level of that is, can you settle it in such a way that it sets up what you want to do next? So the best players can settle the ball and put it a foot and a half away from them to their right side so that they can take a shot. Like, they just have the ability to place it exactly where they want to. So that's what we're talking about in Ultimate a little bit. It's one thing, you got to be able to catch.
Right.
Because we just talked about how awful drops are for us. And we all know that all the players out there who play, when we're calling games, want to make our lives easier.
Right, that's their number one focus.
Because we have not figured out how to react to a drop yet, so let's just get them out.
Right.
We've talked about how, you know, how important that basic skill is, and it is super important, you know, but when you get up further levels, that skill becomes more complex.
It's a matter of how you start manipulating the defense even before they're treating you as a thrower. Which foot is down? Which way are you starting to turn? Which is the defense attacking you? Are they coming from your backside? Are they trying to get a layup block? Are they setting up in a mark even before you've caught the disc? Like, all these things are those cues that you want to pick up almost subconsciously or unconsciously around you through practice. Conscious practice.
Repetition.
Of seeing all these things happen.
Yeah.
And just a simple thing like faking to your left a little bit as you catch. So like your catching motion goes to left side of your body. That can shift your mark over 3 feet. Because they think that you're going to immediately step over and pivot toward your backhand side because of the way that you're receiving the disc. It's just one of those subtle things that as you watch players catch and move into their transition as a thrower, you can sort of learn what they like to do. So a good example of this from one of the players in the MLU that we talk about a lot is Cody Bjorklund.
Oh, yeah.
So his major role on offense seems to be make an underneath cut, gain about 20 yards maybe, get to about mid-distance in their vertical stack, and then turn and throw the disc to Timmy Person deep.
It's very effective.
So I don't mean to say that he doesn't do anything else.
He does lots
His
of other
statistics
things.
And the video evidence will show you he does so many other things. But almost without exception, after he catches the disc, the first place he is looking is to the end zone.
Yeah.
And he gets there quickly, he gets there powerfully, and he's very settled and ready to throw. And this is one of the ways that you learn to address the disc. If you as a mark know that he's doing this all the time, it doesn't help you to be closer to him. You might want to step off a little bit and give yourself a little more time to react. But then that can also be manipulated. So it's this whole cat and mouse game that's happening just before the disc is caught to when the disc is caught.
Mm. Yeah, he does basically a job of, he's almost turning to throw before he's caught it.
Yep.
And doesn't mean he's always going to make that throw, but he's always in a position to make that throw. And he's definitely noticeable if you watch him play. And I think it's interesting, you know, we talked a little bit about there's people that set up their catch and people that are able to create the way that they catch it after the disc is thrown.
Right.
And I think that you brought up a couple of players that have this kind of difference.
Yeah, so one of the players who sets up very consistently before the catch and is ready to manipulate his mark on the catch is Dave Brandolph for Philadelphia. And it's... I think it has a lot to do with basketball background and just other sports background, where it's you understand the weight of players around you, the way they shift their balance a little bit. And he also does a very good job of squaring his body to the person who is throwing him the disc, so he can see the person who's throwing him the disc. The person who's covering him knows that he can see that person. So that's his first option. And he can give a little bit of a balance shift towards that option, and that can cause your mark to overreact. That can cause the secondary defender to overreact. But he's also very good at delivering that pass back for a give and go, right back up the field.
Yeah.
Or reading this side of the field and then turning to the other side of the field because he's done a good job of keeping track of what's back there. But it's that early manipulation and the balance, the shiftiness, right in that small area.
Shiftiness. That should be a rating. We should have a shiftiness rating.
It's, yeah, the ability, yes.
Yeah, yes.
But then we look at the other side of that, and we look at a player like Lloyd Blake for DC, and you see him make catches very casually. This is in part because he's 6'5". It's easy. He's got long arms. Can extend. And in order for players to make defensive bids up there, they generally have to move in at pace.
Yeah.
And you're not generally moving at pace covering a handler.
Yep.
You have to work up to it. So the ease for the catch for him, it allows him to calm his body down. So a lot of the times when he's throwing break passes or things like that after the catch, he settles and then doesn't even really need to step. He just throws it over you or throws to the break side because he's taking advantage of his length and his height as a thrower. So while he can get it quickly from a catch to a throw, it's not as necessary. It's almost more advantageous to catch it when he wants to and then be calm and break down the defense from there.
Yeah, I think when you brought that up, I think of him like the throws up and with a disc, unlike a ball, there's often multiple points in the air where you can catch it. You don't necessarily have to catch it at the very first moment that you're able to. You can let it come by you. You can let it roll past you. Yep. You can catch the trailing edge of it. You can, you know.
And the better the throw is, the more options the receiver has.
I mean, remember Glazer running with it against his face. I don't know if anyone saw that play, but
bounced off a little bit.
He was just riding his cheek for like 3 yards, three or four yards, and then he caught it. Because that's the thing about it. You can let the disc set you up as much as you yourself are setting up your positioning according to the disc. And I think that both those approaches are important. We're running low on time, but I think to recap a little bit here, a little recap. We don't often recap because usually we just run completely out of time. To recap a little bit, drops make us sad.
That's number one.
But they happen. So one of the things that I think both of us are working on, and it'll be interesting to see how it develops, is how do you respond to that kind of abrupt break in a game properly?
Yeah.
And
at the same time, we need to convey the sadness.
The sadness needs to be there.
Because the viewers need to know that the team that just dropped the disc is also sad.
They're very sad. And that's the thing. If you celebrate the drop as an opportunity for the other team, that's also kind of cruel in a way.
Yeah.
So you need to capture both the sadness of the droppy.
Right, the droppy.
And the excitement of its beneficiary. So we're working on that. But in understanding drops and that the fact that they do happen at every level of the sport, also understanding the complexity of the job that the best players do when they're making catches, which seem like such a simple thing. If you're just watching casually, you don't even notice people doing this necessarily.
Yeah.
But the reason that Cody Bjorklund has a look at the end zone all the time is because of the way he's catching the disc.
And one of the ways you can cue on this during games is watch the footwork of the player who is about to catch the disc, who's about to receive the frisbee.
Mm.
See if they're stepping in one direction or another. See if they're landing on both feet. See how many steps they're taking. It'll all tell you about what they were thinking about just before the throw, what they're supposed to do just after the throw, and their ability to manipulate that within the rules.
And this is just on the simplest of catches.
Yeah.
You know. You have difficult catches where you're literally just throwing your hand at it.
I need to catch this.
We'll figure the rest out afterward. But yeah, so keep an eye on that. Very, very cool, very intricate stuff. If you want to talk more about this, Dusty has an inexhaustible amount of energy for this topic.
And this is possibly one of my favorite topics in Ultimate.
Yeah.
Catching to throwing.
So reach out to him at Tweet R.
That's very good.
DustTweetR.
Very good.
Yeah, see, I'm learning. If you want to talk about literally anything else, you can get me at Nick Darling, NICDarling, or you can get us both at Cleats Cufflinks. This weekend, we have just two games.
Two big games, though.
Two big games. The first time that an East Coast team has gotten on a plane and gone across the country. We're very excited to be sending the New York Rumble out to San Francisco to play the San Francisco Dogfish.
Yeah.
And then the matchup that really is the most meaningful in the East right now, Philadelphia headed up to Boston to see if they can win a game up there in Medford Stadium, which is never an easy task. And you can watch both those games at MLULive.com. Dusty will be calling the game up in Boston, and hopefully all of our live streaming stuff will be working, and I will not be calling the San Francisco New York game from here. But you never know. We're gonna wait and see.
Break in case of emergency.
We're prepared for it this time, though. We'll get in there right at the beginning if we need to. That's all the time we have for today.
All right.
Thank you, Dusty. Always good.
Happy to be here.
All right. See you next time on Cleats and Cufflinks.